Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho.
Eight years since you did Talk is Jericho last.
Oh, man. Yeah, we got a lot to catch up on.
Do you remember we met somewhere in London or something at a hotel you came by?
Yeah, you were over for a show, I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a great chat.
It was.
I still think about that chat. It was great. Yeah, we've got a lot to cover today and getting into some of the same stuff.
Well, there's been so much great stuff that you've done since then. But let's just jump right into the new show, Three Body Problem, done by the creators of Game of Thrones. And first and foremost, before we even get into the premise of the show and everything, is it cool for you to know that you're kind of part of the cast of characters for Weiss and Benioff and bringing you back after doing Game of Thrones for so many seasons with them?
Yeah, it's really flattering. And, over the course of my career, I've got lots to be grateful to them for in terms of giving me that chance straight out of drama school, you know, having the faith in me to give me this amazing part to play for 10 years. And it feels like now they've sort of kickstarted the second act of my career, if you like, by giving me a part to play that's completely different to any other part I've ever played before. And I think it's only people who know me really well who give me this part to play. I think that they, over the 10 years we were working together, they sort of got a sense of my real character and my real sort of personality as I am as a person. And they thought, he's never played anything like this before. He kind of plays these meeker guys and guys who are kind of low on confidence. And yeah, it feels a bit like they're moving my acting palette, if you like, into areas that I've never really played before. So it's a bit like they kickstarted the first act of my career with Game of Thrones, and they're kickstarting the second act by giving me a whole new set of things to play. And I'm grateful to them all over again.
So you said that they found you right out of drama school?
Yeah, I was still at drama school when I auditioned for the show. Yeah, and you know, I'm thinking about it now. At the time, yes, but the more you kind of work in film and TV and you sort of understand the way that casting works, for those to have such a big show, have so much responsibility on their shoulders, but to give these very key parts to a lot of actors who hadn't really done anything before, a lot of young, unknown British actors that, you know, there was no guarantee that it was going to work out for any of us, but they took a huge leap of faith. And from then it was all about us repaying that, the faith that they had in us, and working as hard as we could. And I think that that's a kind of work ethic that I've had throughout my career, really. I've coming from a sort of working class background like I did, coming into something like film and TV, you never feel entitled to work, and you never feel sort of entitled to a part. So whenever people do have that bit of faith in you and trust that you can do a job for them, my work ethic has always been to work as hard as I possibly can and repay it.
You're one of those guys, like, you know, when you go into acting, and you know, I've done many auditions and failed most of them. You're one of those guys that it's like got a great part with like your first audition or one of your first auditions. You're one of the people in the acting community that were like, God damn you. How dare you do that?
Yeah. It feels a bit like that sometimes. But like, as time goes on, it's a strange feeling where, you know, to go into something so quickly and something that became such a long running show and is still so talked about and became such a phenomenon that it did. Now you're sort of left with the feeling of, did I peak sort of straight out the gate? You know what I mean? Over the course of a career, you kind of want to be working towards something like
right.
that. Especially now, you know, well, for the last sort of 20 years, really, since Sopranos kicked it all off, where the leads of these big shows are guys in their sort of 40s and 50s a lot of the time.
Right.
They achieve that new level of fame and success at that stage in their life. But it feels to me a bit like, you know, I sort of got an HBO gig straight out of drama school that turned into this big thing. And now I'm just trying to get back up there again. And the chances of doing that are kind of slim.
A friend of mine won the Stanley Cup, which is the hockey trophy in the States,
yeah.
in his first season when he was like 19.
No way.
And never won another one again. He was like, he just thought, well, that's how it is. You just win Stanley Cups every year. And then realized like, oh my gosh, you started at the top. And like you mentioned, now the rest of your career, you're trying to maintain that level of this hit show and these very popular characters.
Yeah. And, you know, like I say, you're always grateful for it. And it set all of us up great for whatever comes next in our careers. But and, you know, there is still another ceiling to get to if we sort of work hard enough. But
sure.
Yeah, it feels a bit like the chances of something like that coming along in your lifetime just once are very unlikely. The chance of it lightning striking twice just feels more and more unlikely all the time. But, you know, we look for interesting parts to play and look for interesting work to do. And even if I don't do anything that big again, it doesn't mean that I won't do anything good again.
Well, no, but and you are doing some big stuff, but it's interesting. I just had Vincent D'Onofrio on, and his first film ever was Full Metal Jacket.
Wow.
He, same thing, came out of basically drama school and went right into this major motion picture. How was it for you going right into the set of Game of Thrones, where it was such a huge production? I mean, I don't know for sure, but the rumors of it's $1 million per episode or very expensive produced episodes, maybe $3 million. And you're getting right in there, right out of the gate. Was it tough for you to acclimate that quickly, or did you just par for the course for you, just learning as you went?
It was more of a sense of how poorly prepared I felt for it, really. Because I went to a drama school in Manchester that was very focused on theatre. We didn't really do much screen training. It was mainly teaching you how to be an actor for the stage. And so when I got this big TV job, when I auditioned for it, I never expected to get it, really. It was my first audition, and I just thought, well, I'll turn up and it'll be a good experience. And
yeah,
I just didn't want to let my agent down with my first audition. So I went in, did the audition, and then they were like, you've got it. And I was like, oh, great. But at the same time, oh no, I've got to do this part now. And I've got to sort of perform in a way that I'm not used to. And especially going onto that set as well, where there are so many people all at the top of their field when it comes to the job that they do. And it's tempting to get a bit intimidated by that and think, oh, poor little me, how am I going to sort of raise my game and work alongside them? But everybody was so welcoming and so patient and everything like that, that if you ever did feel a bit in doubt or a bit imposter syndrome, they pulled you up and they enabled you to perform at your very best for the good of the show. And it was the best training ground, learning curve that I could have ever hoped for, with, you know, some of the best people that I've ever worked for and with.
Yeah, there were so many different levels of actors on that show, from seasoned vets to young guys like yourself. Who did you learn from the most, being such a young actor on a set filled with so many veterans?
Well, I think in life, but especially in sort of entertainment and acting, you know, that thing about you're only ever one handshake away from somebody who will blow your mind.
right.
If you sort of really think about it, they're Peter Vaughan, who played Maester Aemon in Game of Thrones, sadly no longer with us, but I recognized him very clearly. There was a huge sitcom, 70s sitcom called Porridge in the UK, which everybody knows, and it's one of the greats, and he was incredible in it. So I knew him from that. But the more you talk to him and the more you're around him and the more you think about him, and then you find out he did a film with Frank Sinatra. In the 60s, and you think, God, I don't know why I was worried about peaking. I don't know why I was worried about never getting there again, because he was with Frank Sinatra in the 60s, then he's with me in 2010. Talk about a sort of just that kind of thing as well. And just everybody bringing all those experiences. And now I'm one handshake away from Frank Sinatra, and things like that should happen to a guy from the kind of background that I'm from. So yeah, just these little things, and just realizing that you're working with people and they all know what they're doing, but there was no sense of superiority and no sense of a kind of divide between the less experienced and the more experienced. Everybody knew that in order to get the best product onto the screen, everybody has to work as a team. And you know, it's not always like that. And I think looking back, we realize how lucky we were to have that cast and that crew on Game of Thrones. But yeah, it was a very special time, very, very special people.
Yeah, you really do have to have a team mentality when you're making a show like that. It's the better you make your scene partner look, the better it is for the entire show.
Yeah, well, it must be. It's kind of more extreme in terms of your career, in terms of when you're just one-on-one with somebody, you know, in the ring with that crowd, and you have to, in a physical sense with your work, but in a different sense of ours, you just have to trust the other person to keep you safe. And,
right.
And it's a 50-50 dance between the two of you where you've both got the match or the scene in mind, but also keeping each other safe and keeping each other supported. And I think whenever anything comes off, not just entertainment, not just sport, just generally in life, it's where people have each other's interests at heart and make them feel enabled to perform at their very best and safe.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Let's talk about the three-body problem and kind of explain the overall concept of the show, because the trailer looks really interesting, but it looks very multi-layered, this story. It's not just about this, or this. I mean, I know there's kind of a background of aliens and that sort of invasion behind it, but kind of give us a little bit of an overview of what the story is.
Well, watching all the trailers and stuff has been a really sort of interesting experience for us in terms of getting the feedback, because my friends have all said to me after they saw the first trailer, they said, I've never known a trailer where I know less about the show after I watched it.
Your words, not mine.
Yeah.
I was thinking the same, yeah.
It confuses people even more after they've seen it. But part of our story takes place in China in the 1960s. Part of our story takes place in the here and now. And a big chunk of the show takes place in a virtual reality video game. And the story is about one decision that a girl makes in China in the 1960s kicks off a chain of events which leads to humanity in the here and now facing its biggest ever existential threat. I play one of a group of scientists who come together with a detective to try and unsolve the mystery of this existential threat and trying to find ways to prevent it. And, you know, it's based on a very complex and very dense series of Chinese sci-fi novels that are very faithful to science, and when they're quite a confusing read because the book assumes that you know a lot more about science than you maybe do.
Right.
I think with our show, what we're trying to do, and what David and Dan have always been really good at, is taking these very dense and complex ideas, but finding a way of making it more accessible to a wider audience. And yeah, there's a lot going on. They've always managed to find really great human elements in quite complex things. So it's not just a show about science or alien invasion. It's also about humanity, how humanity might deal with a threat like that. And would it unite us or would it divide us? And even in those extreme circumstances, there's still time for friendships to develop and romances and humanity still living their lives in a strange way, even with this existential threat hanging over them. So it is about aliens and alien invasion, but it's also about humanity and relationships, like all great drama and great art is.
Well, and that's the thing too. And that's always, like you mentioned, the best stories. Like Game of Thrones wasn't, you know, it wasn't about White Walkers and dragons per se. It was about families and the connections and problems between families with all of these other amazing things behind it. It's just like Walking Dead. It's not necessarily about zombies. It's about survival and building community.
Yeah.
And those are always the best stories. So this sounds like it's kind of the same vibe, which is with like this alien invasion as the background of it, but more about the human relation.
Exactly, because you have to, alien invasion or, you know, a zombie apocalypse doesn't mean anything unless you care about the people that are at risk.
That's right.
You have to care about the people first and foremost for any of that to have any kind of emotional resonance. And they've changed a lot from the books. They've westernized it. A lot of the show takes place in and around Oxford University, where me and my gang of friends in the show all meet, and they chose Oxford University very deliberately because all human life comes together at places like that. You know, it's not strange to have a group of friends. One of them's American, one of them's Mexican, one of them's from New Zealand, two of them are from England. All of that kind of makes sense there. So we've got a very diverse cast, and I hope that people who haven't read the books like the show for what it is, but I hope that people who do like the books appreciate why we've made the changes that we've made.
Some of those great books, I remember reading Michael Crichton books, you know, Jurassic Park and all of these great books. They're super scientific and you're kind of reading almost a little bit over your head, but you learn a lot. You know what I mean? And then the movies come, they kind of dumb it down just a bit so you can understand, but still very scientific and very intellectual type of books and films as a result. It sounds like that Three Body Problem's the same vibe.
Yeah, completely the same vibe. And it's a very, very ambitious show coming after something like Game of Thrones, which, you know, kind of broke a lot of the rules and raised the bar for what TV could be and the ambition of TV. They've definitely not taken it easy on themselves with this. In many ways, it's more ambitious. And part of that is this device of the virtual reality game that our characters go into, because you can have your settings, you know, China in the 60s and that flashback sequence and, you know, England in the 21st century. But as soon as you're able to put your characters into virtual reality, they can be anywhere.
Mm.
They can be anywhere in history. They can be anywhere in the future. They can be dressed any way you want. They can be interacting with anybody you want. So as a device, it unlocked a door, which gave David and Dan and Alex Wu, our showrunners, a platform to make one of the most visually ambitious shows there's ever been. We did a lot of green screen on the day, but I saw the finished product not so long ago, and some of the visuals in this will blow people's minds, I think.
Let's talk about your character. You mentioned that's a completely different character from what you played on Game of Thrones from Samwell. Mm-hmm. Is this character a little bit more courageous, or what's the story?
Well, I saw an interview with them the other day where I think it was Dan Weiss said they realized halfway through filming Game of Thrones that the person that I am is almost diametrically opposed to the character that I was playing on that show. As an actor, you kind of take that as a compliment, really. Mm. Oh, I was playing somebody completely different. But then you stop and think and you're like, hang on a minute. The character that I played on Game of Thrones was really nice, really nice and really kind and really loyal. So I'm not quite sure what you're trying to say about me here, but he's just somebody that there is a lot of me in that character, but I think that he's the person that I'd want to be all the time if I could. He's somebody who's very, very confident in his opinions, very forthright, doesn't get swayed easily, opinionated in some ways, but if he thinks something, he'll stay on that track and he kind of won't be dissuaded from it. He's got a lot of confidence in himself and faith in his own abilities. And you know, he was a science genius from a very, you know, working class background, but through his extraordinary facility for science, he managed to get to Oxford University, worked out while he was there a new way of making crisps, potato chips, and cocktails that you can mix in a can, dropped out of Oxford, left physics and academia behind, and became a multimillionaire on the strength of that. And he's just living his best life and become a bit of a sort of millionaire playboy in his own way. Not that I am like that in real life. But he's just somebody with a lot of faith in himself and confidence. And it's the least amount of research I've ever had to do. I've just had to turn down all the parts of myself that are polite and accommodating and and listen to other people's opinions and just be the side of me that I would be if I could choose all the time.
A quick segue. What's your thought on prawn crisps?
Prawn cocktail crisp. They're one of those things where whenever I eat them, which isn't very often, I'll always go for a more mainstream flavor. But when I eat them, I think, why don't I have these all the time? Like, why are these not?
You like them?
I do like them. Why are they not my go-to flavor? But I like them, but they're just too controversial to be your first choice crisp.
Yes, for those in the States that don't understand crisp, we're basically talking about shrimp flavored potato chips.
It is that, but it's a prawn cocktail. So basically, it's supposed to be like a sort of Mary Rose sauce.
Okay, more of the sauce flavor than the actual shrimp flavor.
More the sauce flavor, yeah. You can get crisps now that are fried egg flavored.
Wow.
Yeah, but apparently they're really gourmet. I've not tried them, but they're really they're becoming really popular. But that only can taste like oil, right? That can't taste like egg.
I mean, I guess. I mean, I don't know. Like I said, it's one of those things is you when you go over to the UK and see the prawn cocktail crisps.
Yeah,
it's always one of those things where it's like, okay. All right,
but you accept it though.
I accept it. Well, I'm not offended by it.
I'm gonna try and pin you down here, Chris. What's your take on the prawn cocktail? Don't worry about causing an incident.
An internationalist. I'm just not a fan because it's not something that I grew up with. So the concept, and like you said, it's more of the prawn the sauce.
Yeah.
Flavor rather than the actual shrimp, but we don't know this. We just think prawn cocktail that you're gonna have shrimp flavored potato chips, and I don't want that. I roast chicken is fine. The barbecue is good. Salt and vinegar,
yeah.
Sour cream and onion. I'll take all those.
Yeah, it's just what you're used to, isn't it?
Well, yeah, exactly. It's where you grow up. It's one of those things. As a foreigner, you come over, you go, oh my goodness, I've never seen this before.
It's how we feel about Big Red gum. It takes some getting used to, because we're just used to mint flavored gum or
okay
fruit flavored gum if you're being a bit exotic, but a gum that burns.
Yeah, it's true. A hard cinnamon gum. Yeah.
Yeah. I like it, but if you're talking about going out of your comfort zone, it's Big Red for me.
We never thought we'd be discussing Big Red and prawn cocktail during your press junket, did you?
No, but I might get some free crisps out of
both
it.
Of us. It's worth doing. A commercial in the future, Jericho and Bradley, prawn cocktail chips, and then Big Red. We'll do it both.
Yeah.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Did you have to audition for this part? I mean, obviously the guys knew you so well, or was it something you were just offered right away?
Yeah, I was offered it. I heard about it months before I got a sort of official offer through. They gave me a call, I think back in early 2021, and they said, we're doing this show for Netflix. We're not going to tell you too much about it, but we've written a part for you in it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was, I mean, apparently, according to them, the character was called John Bradley for the first three drafts of the script. And then they thought, well, we should probably find a new name for him. So they've called the character Jack Rooney. Jack after, probably shouldn't say this, but Jack something is always the alias that I check into hotels under. And then Rooney after Wayne Rooney, who used to play for Manchester United, one of my all-time favourite footballers. I used to go on and on about him all the time. So Jack Rooney is a kind of amalgamation of my personality and my interests. And yeah, it was kind of tailor-made for me, which is flattering, but I guess when somebody tells you, oh, we've written a part and it's based on you and, you know, it's what we think you're like as a person, you think, God, I'm really going to find out what you think of me now.
Yeah.
It's going to be like when you see yourself drawn by one of those caricature artists on the street and you're like, God, do I really look like that? But I was so flattered to be involved in it. They didn't have to do that. They don't have to do anybody any favors and stuff. So yeah, just to be asked to be part of their next thing before I even knew what it was the easiest yes I've ever done, just to work with them again and play a part in the next stage of their career and their lives was really, really an honor.
Now, you mentioned before with three body problem, and what is the three body problem? Is that an easy answer to give?
It's not an easy answer. It's something to do with, I'm going to really botch this, but if you get two objects that are in gravitational opposition to each other, for example, the Earth and the Moon, and they exert this gravitational pull on each other, what happens if you introduce a third body into that relationship? How do all of these things orbit each other with that same gravitational pull? And the problem being, the main problem is that I don't really understand it. I mean, that's where the problem comes in. But I read the books to try and get some more context into all of this scientific stuff. But I think people who are a bit intimidated by my quite vague explanation of it will find that through the show that we explain it in much more concise.
Oh, I have no doubt. There's such great storytellers, those guys. That's why it's like there's such a trust factor. Like, I don't even care what it's about. I just know that I want to watch it, you know, because it comes from the guys who created Game of Thrones.
Yeah, and they've really pulled out all the stops for it. Netflix have really been behind it from day one. And the way Netflix are promoting it and all that they've invested in it, the time they've invested in it. It took us 18 months to shoot it. It's a long time.
Did you, when you're talking about all the, you know, the virtual reality, and I'm assuming there's a lot of CGI and effects and that sort of a thing.
Yeah.
How do you deal with filming that? Is it all green screen and you just have to pretend, or how exactly do you do that?
It's all green screen. Yeah. I mean, we're usually shown a pre-visual, which is usually just a line drawing of what we're supposed to have in our mind when we're looking at this completely blank screen in order to react to it. But I think that's the weird thing about this stuff. People think that'd be really difficult, but you actually find it really easy when you're a kid. And when you're a kid, the living room of your parents' house could easily be a spaceship,
yeah,
or it could easily be, you know, a pirate ship, or it could be anything you wanted it to be, because you're not hemmed in by any sense of self-consciousness or embarrassment. You can just give yourself over to it. And if you're looking out of your parents' backyard, you can easily react to a horde of enemy charging at you when you're 6 years old. But I think as we get older, we just start to feel a bit awkward and self-conscious and trying to be too cool all the time. So the way I do it is, yeah, I just kind of let go about it. It's not about learning a new skill. It's about unlearning a lot of barriers that you've put in place and just giving yourself over to your own sort of imagination.
That's a great point. You're totally just going back into your early days where you close your eyes and there's a whole world out there.
Yeah, the days when I used to run around our house with my dad had a black suit jacket that I used to put over my head, and I used to pull the sort of collar up so it looked like horns, and I used to pretend to be Batman for hours and hours at a time. If there was any way in the world that you can imagine that my dad's cheap black suit jacket with the collar turned up was the Michael Keaton Batman suit. If you can con yourself into thinking that, everything else is just easy.
I grew up in Winnipeg in Canada, so there's always lots of snow. So every winter in like 81, 82 was hot.
Oh yeah.
You know, when you had your recess from school and you had 20 minutes to go out and say, let's go, it's hot. You play Hoth for 20 minutes and you go back to social studies, and that's makes it worthwhile.
Yeah. It's funny that, isn't it? It's funny the way that, I mean, I hope it's the same now than it used to be, but to some of the things that you just used to make up and pretend when you were bored. I mean, now everything's on a screen, so you don't really understand. It's a kind of old guy thing to say, and I know that I'm not breaking any ground with this opinion, but when I think about what we had to entertain ourselves, it's nothing compared to what kids have now. But we managed.
Mm-hmm.
We managed and we sort of got through it, and it gave us like an appreciation of things like that. But myself and my little pals from school getting our own wrestling federation together when we were 10 years old and injuring ourselves by falling over on the concrete schoolyard and all that stuff, it was always I think that's where you get a community as a kid as well.
Sure.
Because you're not just isolated with your own screen, you have to find common interests with the people around you, and you all have to buy into this conceit of, should we pretend to be wrestlers, or should we pretend to be firemen? Should we pretend to be the, like, whatever you're pretending to be? You all have to buy into that together, so you create a little community through that.
Do you, with this show being so involved with, like you mentioned, the kind of the basic background is the alien experience. And right now in the States, there's, you know, commissions talking about aliens, and they're having government discussions about this. What are your thoughts on all that stuff that's going on right now as far as the alien element in the world?
I'll tell you a really interesting thing that our show sort of examines, really, in a universal sense, but there are parallels to be drawn in much more sort of direct terms, that if it's part of humanity's sense of itself and, you know, sense of opposition, that as soon as, if we found out that aliens existed today, the first thing we'd think is, oh, what are they going to do to us?
Mm-hmm.
What is the threat here?
Right.
Well, the fact of the matter is, if aliens did exist, they may not be up for taking over the world or killing us all, or, you know what I mean? But yeah, we're so programmed to see any kind of otherness as a threat that as soon as aliens, if they're confirmed to exist, they become the enemy instantly.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what our show does in terms of makes us think about, just because something's other doesn't mean that it's necessarily out to kill us or out to replace us. It's perfectly possible for another alien, for an alien race, another civilization to exist on a planet, and we just both exist on our own,
yeah,
peacefully. And even if they did want to invade, maybe they're just curious, or maybe there's a threat on their planet which they're trying to escape, and who are we to sort of not help them out? So it's an interesting thing that it's just part of that fear, isn't it? And you know, it's part of the fear of how can we be expected to forge a bond with aliens when we hate the guys that live next door.
Right.
Any sense of otherness is always seen as a threat. And I think that, yeah, the show goes into that quite sensitively and quite cryptically, but everything's based on fear. People aren't curious about the idea of aliens existing. They're just first and foremost scared.
Well, I think a lot of it's because of movies too, right? It's like the same
reason. Yeah.
People are terrified of sharks because of Jaws.
Yeah.
Peter Benchley said the worst thing he could have ever done for sharks was write that book, because now everyone thinks sharks are going to kill you. And meanwhile, I mean, it happens, but sharks are pretty, pretty docile, cool creatures of the deep. But it's a shark. It's totally an alien, you know?
That very primal sort of Neanderthal self-preservation kicks in. And,
right,
you know, that sense of inadequacy, and you know, it causes a lot of trouble in the world and in relationships between people, where people feel insecure, or you know, feel that they're in danger, or feel that there's a threat, and they overcompensate, and then they become the aggressive. You'll see
right?
That in any bar in the world.
Yeah.
This weekend, guys who are worried that they're getting, people are taking the piss out of them, or you know, they feel that they're not as big as that guy, and look at his muscles, and look at his car, and look what he's got, and then that makes them the person who's more likely to start the trouble. It's all of these big existential universal things, they can all be boiled down to how people feel internally, and I think that's a really interesting parallel to explore.
Let's talk a little bit more about Game of Thrones and the fact it's the biggest hit of the 21st century, with almost 60 Emmy Awards. When did you start feeling that this thing was becoming bigger than just a normal show? Because you mentioned you come right out of school, acting school, you're in this role, you're in this show, and suddenly it just blows up. When did that start feeling different for you as far as everyone sort of getting behind this?
The first couple of seasons, it was gaining traction and gaining a fan base. But I think when we went from season 2 to 3, that was when we first started to feel the momentum gathering. And that was the first time that the cast were brought over to America to do a big launch for the show. And that was a big moment as well, because, you know, it was a primarily British cast, and we filmed it in Northern Ireland. So we didn't really get a sense of how big it was. It was always an American show. But because we had to fly like 50 minutes to film it, and everybody had familiar accents, and it all felt very, very small in its own way, and kind of intimate, to come to America and see what it meant to people here and the fan base that we had here, and to be treated by HBO like this big commodity that they wanted to promote and really get behind. I think that was it. And also the difference between people who started the show on season one, where they didn't know how big it was going to be, and we had a lot of faith in it, but we didn't know it was going to be a phenomenon. The difference between us and people who joined the cast in season three and season four, because they knew that they were joining a big thing. It was guaranteed that this was going to kind of raise their profile, and they were going to be in something that everybody was watching and everybody knew was good. I think that's when we started to get a sense of how other people felt about being on the show. That's when we started to really get a sense of, we are sort of the biggest job in town as far as actors go. Actors want to be in our show now. And
sure,
you know, over the years, we managed to get great people in it. We got, established legends of acting, really, like Jonathan Pryce, who's in Three Body Problem as well. I got to do some things with Jim Broadbent, Oscar winner. I think that's when it is now, when these people who don't really have to work, their motivations for working have changed over the course of their careers. And now they just want to come onto something that they know is good and they know is successful. And the prestige of that, when you start to realize what other people think of your show, I think that's when your opinion on it changes. And you start to think, we're doing all right.
I mean, when Ed Sheeran wants to be in your show, what more do you want?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Talk about a missed opportunity. I was hoping he would get beheaded or something. He's singing in the forest. I thought he's going to get beheaded.
So many musicians over the years, because David and Dan, they're big music guys.
Right.
Dan Weiss, especially, he's a metalhead, and he had his idols growing up. And you can kind of, one of the great privileges is when you can use your success to meet people that you
want
to meet and put them in your show. So we always had musicians wanting to be in the show, and Dan wanting to meet all of his heroes. And yeah, it was a nice little mutual fanboying.
How did you deal with fame? Obviously you were a young guy at the time and you're on the hottest show in the world. Did you just take it in stride, or was it interesting and strange for you at first?
It was kind of strange, but I think what I've always wanted to do and always managed to do is to keep my home life pretty consistent. I still live in Manchester, where I grew up, and I still see my old friends and I see my family all the time. So it wasn't like I sort of bought into the fame thing as a lifestyle. It's tempting, and I totally understand it. And part of me maybe now regrets that I didn't buy into it a little bit more. But going to LA and living a sort of more entourage-y right. lifestyle and really enjoying yourself and really enjoying the moment. I was always a bit too keen maybe to get back to Manchester, to people who knew me before, who I knew were going to treat me just exactly the same. And I just think, you're always, everything's so unpredictable. If you sell your friends and your old friends and your family kind of down the river and you don't see them anymore because you bought into this new mythology around yourself, you're only one show cancellation away from that all going away,
mm-hmm.
that disappearing completely. And then you're left with nothing because you can't go back home because you turned your back on them and you're not welcome in those circles anymore. So
I
was very determined to sort of keep what I knew to be constant and consistent close to me. And it's still the case.
How did you feel overall about Samwell's character arc from season one to season eight? There's a lot of development for this character, very, very deep character towards the end.
Yeah, I think he had a really beautiful character arc when it came to, in terms of what he discovered about himself over the course of those seasons. People say, how do you feel about Sam becoming brave? And it's a bit like, no, it's not so much that he was always brave. He just didn't know it. He just wasn't allowed to think it because he was indoctrinated with a very clear and sort of toxic sense of what a brave person is. And he thought, well, I'm not like that. I can't swing a sword around. I can't kill lots of people. So therefore, I mustn't be brave. But his braveness was definitely within him. And I think over the course of the season, it's kind of inspiring for a lot of people as well who don't fit the mold of what we physically especially consider to a hero to look like. You don't have to look like a hero to be one. Over the course of that series, Sam's discovery about his own bravery and his own worth, there was very few like big moments of realization for him. But it was just tiny little things along the way, the instinct to protect and the instinct to do things in his own way to help the greater good. I thought that, yeah, that voyage of self-discovery that he went on was hopefully universal and relatable for people, but it felt like a privilege to play that kind of arc.
Well, he ended up in a pretty good spot at the end too. He's kind of the advisor to the new king, right?
Yeah. And, you know, bringing his own very unique set of skills to the fold. Part of a sort of fan service arc would be, oh, he does become a great fighter, a war strategist like his dad was, and that's the way he manages to get some sense of redemption. But no, it was all about, no, you're good. The things that you can do are different, but they're just as worthwhile as what other people can do, other people that you may look at and think, oh, I wish I was like that. You're good. Nobody else can do what you do. And he was able to do it at the very top level. And yeah, it was lovely.
What did you think about the reaction to the final few episodes? And there's a huge hardcore fan backlash. They want to reshoot the last couple episodes and just this whole brouhaha over that. What was that like for you?
It's interesting amongst the cast as well. There are sort of different ways that you can respond to that. Some people got very combative and defended the show. They basically said that, I can't really think of anybody in particular, but there was a certain thing, mainly amongst the fans, actually, that would just be like, oh, the people who criticize it don't know what they're talking about, and it's like this for a reason. And I think initially the main emotion was just one of kind of just sad that people didn't enjoy it, I think.
Yeah.
A lot of people did enjoy it, I should say. And, you know, as a cast, we were happy with it. And I think there is merit in it, but it's just the negative voices tend to be the loudest voices. That's just across the board. But I've always sort of had the fans in mind. If you listen to some actors talk, I suppose it's getting more and more the case, you sort of start to think that the audience are the last thing on their mind sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's about making it all about themselves. This is what I got from it. And it's kind of all about me. And I don't really care if an audience like it or not.
Right.
As long as I do the kind of work that I want to do. But I think that the audience have always been at the forefront of my mind. And I want to do everything I can to make them enjoy it as much as they possibly can. And when something doesn't quite come off, I'm not going to say that their opinions weren't valid. If that's what they think, then their opinion is valid. It was just a bit like, oh, I was just a bit sad that people didn't kind of respond to it in the way that we hoped they did. But it was always going to be tough to end a show like that, that's so well thought of and has won so many awards. It was always going to be tricky to find an ending that pleased everybody. Social media backlash, everything becomes really amplified.
Sure it does.
And now people, for the first time in the last 10, 15 years, is the first time that people have ever been able to really directly tell you what they think of it. They have access to your phone and you can just sit scrolling it if you're of a mind to. But on social media, it becomes really vitriolic and unnecessarily mean and personal. If you see people in the street, they're not as angry as they make.
Of course,
they make out they are on social media.
But, that's right.
But when it's taken out of context and you just see the words written down, it can start to feel a bit more aggressive than it probably is in reality. But it was an interesting time, and I just hope now, with Three Body Problem, that David and Dan are able to reassert their claim as being masters of what they do. People forget that they were in charge of Game of Thrones when it was the universally considered to be the best show that was on at the time, and I just hope that this show, man, you know, is able to restore their rightfully deserved reputation. And if they can pull off this adaptation and pull off this story, then I think that people are gonna recalibrate their ability and give them a bit of praise that they, you know, they deserve.
Well, once again, I mean, like you said, there's the hardcore fan base. I mean, I get it all the time from wrestling, and even with Fozzy, with my band, it's like, they're going to complain about anything and everything. And when you go into an arena or on the street, everybody's enjoying it and having the best time. And then you go, if you choose to go into this online world, then you get what you get. You know what I mean? I think you just got to not worry about that as much. Because I thought the ending of Game of Thrones, yeah, obviously a little controversial, but I thought it was a pretty cool ending. Like, there's a couple ways you could go with it. But how are you supposed to end this amazing story in this amazing world? You got to make a couple choices. And I think, you know, once again, I thought it was actually fairly well done, but you know, other people hate it and they're going to go online and just kind of get to your head if you allow it to.
Yeah, exactly. It's best to just kind of block it out. But I was thinking about this recently because, you know, I'm a big football fan and I engage a lot with football, my club, Manchester United, and my favorite players on social media and stuff. But I'm just not sure what that would be like where, but just because you play for a certain football club, or even if you take into politics, if you represent a certain political party, then 90% of the population just hate you just on the basis of
sure.
that.
Yeah.
And everything that you do, every time you appear in public doing your job, you're just inviting so much criticism. And if we think that we kind of had it bad, every time a sportsman or sportswoman, sports person steps onto their field of play, they're just kind of opening themselves up for ridicule. And I think whenever we're feeling a bit beleaguered or a bit under the cosh for certain people's opinions, I just think, God, how do my heroes, how do they cope with it? And it must be just really get them down somehow. But you've just got to be a professional. You've just got to carry on.
Yeah, thick skin. Last thing about Game of Thrones, what was your favorite scenes from Samwell? There's a couple that stand out as being kind of classic moments in the show even.
I think, well, the sort of turning point for him in, I think it was season three, was killing the White Walker in season three.
Yeah.
It was just massive, not just because it was, you know, narratively as far as the plot and, you know, finding out that this kind of dagger can kill White Walkers and then what that did for, you know, the war against them going forward. But just in terms of the, you know, that character's moment of, he did it to protect Gilly and he did it to protect the baby. And that was when you start to see that when the things that he loves are threatened, he doesn't mind, you know, rolling his sleeves up and going into battle and using what he can to keep them safe. So yes, that was a massive moment in terms of the plot, but it was just a massive moment in terms of his character development and, you know, just starting to see a bit of that bravery coming through. And that's a sort of before and after point for Sam and the audience's relationship with him as well. The first time you sort of see him in that mode. And yeah, I think that the audience recalibrated what they thought of him after that.
Yeah, there was some great scenes too, and that when the White Walker is actually approaching Sam and he's hiding behind the rock and all that sort of stuff, that was very, very cool.
Yeah. There was so much later on in the series when he goes back home and he goes and sees his father for the first time in a long time, ever since his father banished him from his home and his rightful seat as the head of that family. To go back and steal the sword and
yeah.
all of that symbolism of taking what he's rightfully his, that he feels he's been hoodwinked out of because he's not the right body and he's not got the right toxic attitude. Just that bit of gumption to just sort of stand up to his father, not in a spectacular way. Fans might have wanted him to kick the door in and start pointing fingers and start shouting and ranting and raving, but the character wouldn't do that. The character would find a way to win that moment in his own way. And I thought that was really satisfying.
As we start to wind down here, you had a couple other really great roles after Game of Thrones. I mean, obviously, Game of Thrones ends. Is a little bit of a letdown for you? Is it kind of hard to not have this show to go to every season?
Yeah, it was. It was very difficult to have because we always shot in the second half of the year. Mm-hmm. So from August to Christmas, pretty much, that was your year set out. And just to be without the consistency of that, suddenly you sort of felt adrift. And it was that weird thing of, I had a seat at this table and a sort of place, an invite to this party that now I'm suddenly on the other side of. And other shows were coming in that were sort of adopting the place that we held as that sort of appointment to view show that everybody was talking about. And you start to feel, oh, maybe it's just over. Maybe that was my go. Maybe that was my time. And now I'll just sort of muddle along. And it took a sort of long time to find the right thing. And I didn't want to be playing a similar part in in sort of substandard copies.
Right. Of the same sure, yeah.
So it took a while. And then the next thing I did after Game of Thrones was a rom-com with Jennifer Lopez and Owen Wilson, which as far as a completely contrasting thing to Game of Thrones, I couldn't have hoped for anything more, really. A contemporary but glamorous, fun, romantic, sort of music-centric rom-com playing a character that wasn't quite as meek, a character that was more dynamic and more capable. And it was quite a long wait for that. It took me, you know, over a year to find that. But once I found it, I was just very sort of, this is what I do next. And this feels like exactly the right thing to do. So I'm glad I waited. It's a kind of testament to patience.
Didn't J-Lo actually kind of request to have you play that part?
Yeah. It definitely sort of came from her producer, because Jennifer, she was a producer on that movie. And so she had a say on all the casting. But yeah, Elaine Goldsmith-Thomas, the production partner, I think, and also I think she told me that she sort of thought about me for this part when she saw me on Ellen DeGeneres' chat show, which filled me with so much sort of confidence, really, because it was a bit like, oh, they've sort of seen me as I am. They don't want a Samwell Tarly.
Right.
They don't want me to sort of repeat that performance again. They've seen something in me as myself that they thought I could bring to this part. So apparently they said that I had, indirectly, I've got Cardi B to thank for being in that movie. Because apparently when she was in Hustlers, the movie with Jennifer, they only had her for one day. So they shot all Cardi B scenes in one big day. And Elaine got back to wherever she was staying, I think, and she was tired and she just put the TV on just to sort of wind down a bit. And my episode of Ellen was being repeated as she was, it's just about all these things that could.
Yeah, right.
Which lead to things. And that's what made her think of it for the next movie they were going to make after that, which turned into Marry Me. So yeah, you just never know who you've got to thank, and you just never know what sort of balls are being juggled while you're back in Manchester with your old pals, and you just don't know what's going on that's going to shape the next thing to happen to you.
You never know who's watching. I always say that. You never know who's watching.
Exactly.
Last few things for you, John. So is Three Body Problem, is it a one season all encapsulated show, or is the idea to do more seasons with this?
Yeah, there's definitely more scope to do more of them. It's based on, it's a trilogy of books.
Okay.
This mainly, we've taken elements from some of the later books, but it mainly focuses on the first one. So if this goes down well, it could continue for another few seasons at least.
Last question for you. What's your favorite part about playing Jack Rooney after playing Samwell Tarly for so many seasons, so many years?
Just the freedom of it. To play a character that isn't, the hard thing about playing Sam was playing somebody who just was so low on confidence and so inward looking and so shy and second guessed himself all the time and had a lot of trauma, had bad relationships with his family. And he just felt like a real physical weight to sort of carry all of that trauma and that pain around within that character for so long. And Jack's just somebody who never really lets anything get to him too much. I'd like to think that he's the friend that everybody wishes that they had. He's the friend that you'd call up if there was something wrong to cheer you up and make you feel better about things. You know, he's argumentative and he's obnoxious and he's opinionated sometimes, but there's a lovable side to him as well. So it felt like even having a day off from all of my insecurities and all of my shyness that comes out sometimes and just be the person that I want to be, I would choose to be all the time if I could. It was like a holiday from all of my insecurities.
Well, dude, it's great talking to you, man. It's been a while, but likewise. Congratulations on all your success and looking forward to seeing this, and hopefully we'll run into each other at a football match on the pitch. Fulham.
Let's do it, man. I really hope you like the show, Chris. It's so good to talk to you again, mate.
Yeah, man. We'll keep in touch. It's good talking to you, dude.
Likewise, mate. Thanks a lot.
Take care, man. Bye.